Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts recalled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was titled History and Mystery, Weaving a Web of Truth and Lies in Detective Fiction. Writing historical crime fiction is like a treasure hunt for authors who dig up nuggets from the past to recreate old crimes and mysteries, both real and imaginary. How do authors lay down clues to keep readers and their central characters guessing who done it? How do you balance the interlacing stories of detective, murder, and victim? What sources do authors use to set the scene and solve the crime using old-fashioned methods of crime detection? Felicity Pullman tracks down the answers to these questions and more with Marla Nunn, Catherine Kovarkig, and Tessa Lumney.
Marla Nunn has made three award-winning films, as well as being the author of four internationally published Detective Emmanuel Cooper novels, which I really enjoy, set at the beginning of the apartheid era in 1950s South Africa. A Beautiful Place to Die. Do you want to just...
Oh, yes. I keep forgetting.
Show and Tell, Show and Tell.
There it is,
A Beautiful Place to Die, Let the Dead Lie, Blessed are the Dead and Present Darkness have between them received two Edgar Award nominations, a Rusa Award for Best Mystery Novel and a Davitt Award for Best Crime Novel by an Australian author. Her debut YA novel, When the Ground is Hard, was released in June this year in American Australia. Born and raised in Eswatini, which is the new word for Swaziland, in Southern Africa, Mala now lives and works in Sydney. So take it away, Mala.
All right. Well, obviously, I'm very impressive. Look at all this. I listen to that stuff and I just go, I'm some person that sits in a house in Bexley and makes up stories. And it's wonderful. It's like the best, it's the best living I can imagine. I absolutely adore it. And I didn't start out as a writer. But I always started out very, very interested in history. So I did an undergrad degree in English and history as sort of two majors. And then they both ended up being exactly what I do now. I write and I do historical research. But we haven't got a huge amount of time, but I got into it because I really loved history, and then I did a documentary in South Africa, and I just thought, what a pit of snakes this place is, to figure out culturally, everything was just, I found every interaction really hard, because everyone was signaling who they were by race, by class, and I'm from Australia, and I was just like, why are people doing this? And I just was so fascinated. And I talked to my mother, who the documentary was about, and she said, oh, well, Molly, you know, the 50s changed everything. That was when apartheid was introduced. So I went, at the end of this documentary, I got married in traditional ceremony in Swaziland. And I was at the edge of a river, and I looked out, and I mean, it was a visual image of a dead body in a river. And I thought, I'm going to write a crime book. And it had not occurred to me that, I mean, I was a big fan of crime. I read tons of crime. But I just thought, oh, and he's a policeman. It's like, you know where your brain just, and then what happens is that news just goes, well, I'm going to leave it up to you now, and just walks out of the door. And you're like, listen, get back here. But that's what happened, and I end up, and that moment ended up being A Beautiful Place to Die, which is kind of my entry point into writing as something to do for a living, because at the time I was working on film sets and nothing sexy. I was the person that was running in with coffee. Or going, oh, I've got to deliver this to North Sydney, and then I've got to... It was interesting, but I'm glad that I got out of that and I got into writing. So I adore what I do, and I love history, and I love, you know, the combination of history and English. And they said I'd never get a job with those two kind of very arty things. But yes, so we're going to talk about writing a bit later. So I'm going to up to you. You jump in now and tell us.
Well,
where would you want me to go?
You've said, what do you want to
say? Oh, absolutely, because okay. we're going to chat. Okay. I'd much more talk with other writers than talk about myself, yeah.
Okay. Hang on. Oh, let me introduce you.
Okay. Oh, yes, you've got the intro.
Please. Back to you, please.
The intro.
Yes. Get ahead of ourselves here. Okay, so this is Catherine Kovacic.
That's pretty good, yeah.
So Catherine's a former veteran... Oh, I'm having trouble with words today. Veterinarian turned art historian with a PhD in art history. She lives in Melbourne with a... I had to get the pronunciation of this, a and a Scottish deerhound, which perhaps explains the presence of the lovable Hogarth in her debut novel, The Portrait of Molly Dean,
shown here.
This is based on the true story of an unsolved murder in the 1930s. Her second novel, Painting in the Shadows, was published in March this year, and she's currently working on a non-fiction book that will be published by the National Library of Australia.
Excellent.
Anyway, that was Portrait of Molly Dean. So, as Flick said, this was based on a true story. And I came across Molly, or Mary Dean was her real name, but she went by Molly. I came across her story many years ago when I was researching a group of Melbourne artists called the Meldrumites. And they're a 1920s, 1930s group. Who was centred around a guy called Max Meldrum, who was pretty grumpy but very dynamic. And she wasn't an artist, but she hung out with the bohemian set, effectively, and she was the lover of one of the leading artists in this circle, Colin Colohan. And she was brutally murdered in 1930, and the crime was never solved. So she sort of kept on cropping up in various bits of research that I was doing with these people, but because it was an unsolved crime, and then when I did a bit of looking at it, all the files had disappeared from the Public Records Office and the Police Department, which was another little interesting thing. So I didn't really know what to do with her story, and so it was just sort of always there ticking away in the back of my mind. And then a few years ago, I was helping to curate an exhibition on Colin Colohan, and I was researching some of his more obscure exhibition catalogues, and catalogues in the 20s and 30s weren't big, glossy, illustrated things, they're these little pamphlets. And about number 11 in the list was Portrait, Molly Dean. So I contacted the leading expert on Colin Colohan. I said, I got this catalogue. He said, yep, I've got all the catalogues. And I said, so number 11? And he said, yeah, don't know where that one is. And this is a guy who'd spent his entire career cataloguing every work by this artist. Mm. So Colin Colohan painted a lot of portraits of women. It's actually very interesting because you can kind of get an idea of the ones he was probably sleeping with because there's a little bit more of that kind of going on. But he was a society portraitist as well. So the painting could still be out there, which is probably the moment where I should say, if you come across a portrait by Colin Colohan of a young woman, 25 years of age, short brown hair, please call. I'd like to know. But in any case, there was this lost portrait. And at about the same time, because I was researching Colin Colohan, I came across another reference to Molly. And this one particularly stuck with me because it was a timeline of Colin's career. And I went, 1930, Colin's lover brutally murdered, his career stalls. And I thought, that's really horrible that this woman's life has been reduced to being not even just a footnote in his life, but a really inconvenient footnote. His career stalled. So I thought, well, now I've got her story, and I've got this missing portrait. And it was the missing portrait that gave me sort of the angle to get into her story, which was to create a protagonist who is an art dealer who would find this portrait and then want to get the backstory, not because they really cared, but because they wanted to sell the painting for more, obviously, because that's what you do when you're an art dealer. You get a little bit of juicy detail. But then, of course, my protagonist, Alex Clayton, becomes more involved in the story, and then stuff happens. So that was my intro into this story. And so the first thing I had to do was find out more about Molly Dean. And when she was murdered in 1930, she was 25 years old. She was about 5'6". She was a very bright and bubbly girl. She was a teacher in a school in North Melbourne in what was called the opportunity class, which was every student who had some sort of educational disadvantage, mm-hmm. whether that was a learning disability or deafness or visual impairment, all went into Molly's class, and she had about 60 kids in the class. She was really good. She was a very good teacher. I found the education department records that went through her reports, and she was really great at what she did. But she wanted to be a writer. Welcome to the group. So she was prepared to chuck everything to pursue her career as a writer, and that's where she was in 1930, hanging out with the bohemian crowd, even though she was a middle-class girl. really on the brink of throwing everything away to become this writer. She'd had some short stories published, she'd had a poem published, and she had a book underway.
Don't tell too much of the story.
I won't tell too much of the story, but I will tell you that the title of her book was Monsters, Not Men. And that's the only thing that survives of her book. So that's what she was running away from. She was also running away from her mother, who was a particularly brutal character. But I'm not going to tell you more about her mother because you'll find out about that. And her mother really was. It was almost bordering on being a psychopathic person. Anyway, so that was my first book, Molly Dean, which was a really interesting venture into melding that historic fact with fiction to give her a resolution of sorts. But when I'd finished doing that, I found that I still had this protagonist, Alex Clayton, my art dealer, in my head. And she was kind of annoying because the art world is really grubby. There's just all these dirty little corners with forgeries and stuff like that. So when I'd be back doing the paying job, curating exhibitions and things, you know, I'd be looking at paintings and suddenly I'd have this voice in my head going, hey, that painting, did I ever tell you about the time? I'd be like, no, but please do. But then, as Mala said, she'd just be like, not right now. So anyway, that was the second book. Alex Clayton came back again to do another thing, and that's pretty much entirely fiction except for the bit about the cursed painting, which is the true part. So that's kind of weird. But anyway, and then there is a third Alex Clayton book coming out in April next year, which is called The Shifting Landscape. So, yeah, and there's still plenty more grubby art to look at.
Well done. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so our final panellist is Tess Lunny. And Tess is a novelist, poet and occasional reviewer. Her debut novel, April in Paris, show and tell, 1921, sorry, was published by HarperCollins and Pegasus Books in the USA. She won the prestigious Josephine Ulrich Prize for Literature from Griffith University for, I'm assuming this is a short story, Chess and Dragonflies.
Yes, yes.
In 2016, and the Orlando Prize for Fiction for her story, Those Ebola Burners. Oh, sorry, Those Ebola Burners Them.
Yep.
She's also been the recipient of a Varuna Fellowship and has a doctorate in creative arts from Western Sydney University, which explored silence in Australian war fiction. In 2014, she was awarded an Australian Council Art Start grant for literature. Her poetry, short fiction and reviews have been published in many magazines and journals. So... Lucky last, welcome, Jess, and take it away.
Sure, I'm gonna talk a little bit about the link between history and mystery in my novel and how I approached it in the writing. So this panel is called History and Mystery, but for me the history came first very much, and the mystery was much more a distant second. With writing April in Paris, 1921, it was a question of taking another time and exploring what rankled within that historical period, particularly for me as a 21st century woman, and then putting that within my starry-eyed fascination of 1920s Paris. I'm really drawn to the 1920s. I'm very interested in the Molly Dean book. 1920s for its art and its feminism, its wild parties and its wilder politics. The combination of optimism and instability, the sense of partying on the edge of the abyss, feels very familiar. 1921 is right at the start of the interwar period, and so near the start of the build-up of the clashing ideologies that formed World War II and the Cold War, ideologies that I feel have reappeared today, even while the tensions have remained pervasive. I like to use this period of the past to gain a perspective on the present, to test my own reactions to the present by putting my first-person narrator, Kiki Button, into this period. For example, when I was writing the first draft of the novel, it was 2016, so Brexit had been debated and then voted in, Trump and Hillary were debating and Trump had been voted in, and so these politics of populism and popular rhetoric were very much in the forefront of my mind. Even though I was pregnant and I'd just had a baby, it was inescapable. During the rallies that led up to Trump's victory in the American election, more than one newspaper ran articles that pointed out the similarity of these meetings to the fierce political rallies of the 1930s. And left-leaning papers like The Guardian or The New York Times, if you read them, are still very interested in the rise of populism and popular rhetoric in Europe and America. And he goes with this popular rhetoric, a very difficult to ignore if you are a student of this period of the 1920s and 30s. But it made me wonder, are the similarities only in the rhetoric? What are the fundamental differences? And there are some very fundamental differences between then and now. And as always, I'm very interested in daily life. So how can you put big P politics, this idea of populism, into the day-to-day living, both mine and of a 1920s Parisian? How can my 21st century privilege compare with the sense of post-war World War I desolation? I don't really have any answers. Usually the writing only provides more questions, but it's certainly the right writing myself into it through a first-person narration brings up some interesting parallels. So when we're talking about mystery and talking about politics, this naturally leads more towards a spy mystery than a murder mystery. Spy work always has to do with the affairs of nations, individuals intervening in big P politics. My main character, Kiki Button, was a nurse in World War I and unofficially a spy. When she returns to Paris in 1921, she's contacted by her old spy master and once again becomes an unofficial spy for the British government. Of course, I give her a mission that accords with my interests a century later, mainly how fascism came to have such a hold on mainland Europe. Fascism began right in this period, in the aftermath of World War I, feeding off the bitterness and anger left over from the war, which infected the victors, not quite as much, but as well as the defeated. That fascism, like all politics, is so intimately bound up with human emotion, made it very interesting to work with. I throw a reluctant spy into the chaos, and I have someone that I can use to make sense of both that time and now. For me, the period not only gives her the reason to spy, but it created her whole character. Paris had been a beacon, a refuge, a world unto itself for the wild and the radical for quite a long time. Revolutionary Paris, Bohemian Paris, Belle Epoque Paris, Paris full of soldiers on leave, and now post-war Paris. Expats and travellers had long found the license to be different in this city. My focus in the book is on the Anglophone expats, mainly from Britain and America, but also Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and so on. They were drawn to Paris as much by the fantastic post-war exchange rate as they were by the artistic communities of Montmartre and Montparnasse. They could really live on their art in Paris, which they never could have in London. These expats were rule breakers and world shakers, and what I liked as well is that the period gave us as many famous and talented women as men. Gertrude Stein, Natalie Barney, Nancy Cunard are just as well known, or maybe not just as well known, but are equally known as Picasso, Hemingway, Fujita, etc. They often came from poverty or provinciality, or at least perceived provinciality, to Paris to be modern and free, and of course, to be in the company of like-minded social revolutionaries. I ensconce Kiki Button in this world because she's in Paris for many of the same reasons, and she really, well, I let her exploit her freedom to the full. She's not running to something, but from something, mainly her parents' determination to marry her off and insistent traumatic memories of the war. And she builds a barrier against these evils in Paris with champagne, sex, gossip, parties, old friends, new friends, and the enduring magic of the city. She has a post-war wonder at being alive, refusing her war-weary cynicism and hurtling into the new. This doesn't sound much like a mystery story. It's not meant to. As well as being a mystery, this book is also a party book and a book about modern love and a book about Paris, which is one of my favourite subgenres. I tried to treat weighty issues like fascism and war trauma lightheartedly, as much as one can, in order to combat, for me, what was the endless sexual violence of contemporary crime novels, which were very difficult to read while I was pregnant and breastfeeding, and also to combat the fashion for writing about World War I as beautifully tragic. In my research in my doctorate that Felicity mentioned, I found that often soldiers often used humour to combat grief, admittedly a very dark humour, and for me the unrestrained parties of the 1920s is another version of this impulse. Through a first-person narration, I have my character diffuse all the serious in her life with a new lover and another cocktail, and if they fail, with her wit. Kiki has these options because it's the 1920s, because she's run away to Paris, and because single middle-class women working and living alone was the new reality of post-war one Europe. In that sense, both the mystery and her character are shaped by that place at that time, how it functioned within itself, and how it functioned within a wider context. I have more, but have I run out of time now? Yes.
Have you got much? Is there much more?
Well, yeah, I wrote a 10-minute speech, so as you asked me to.
Well, yes, so. Yes, things have changed a little bit. But, I mean, you can see from listening to these lovely panellists that history and mystery combine very, very well indeed. And I think you, Tessa and Catherine, have given us a lovely insight into the ideas and also into the research behind what goes into these novels. So I'm going to throw it back to you, Mala, to talk maybe a little bit about the research that you might not have needed to do.
Right.
You talked a bit about where the inspiration came from. And then we might just pick it around a little bit between everyone.
So when I got the crime idea, and I thought, I'm going to write crime, but it's going to be in the 50s, and I was like, I don't know much about that period, so the first.
You just haven't lived long enough.
I haven't lived long enough. Yeah, well, the first people I talked to were my parents,
of course,
because they'd gone through it and they'd lived through this transition between a time in South Africa where everyone knew the rules, but if you broke the rules, people ignored it or they thought you were a bit naughty, and then suddenly you went from being a bit naughty to being thrown in jail. This is for crossing any of these lines. So suddenly you have a society that used to slightly be malleable on the edges where people could disappear and do what they needed to do. Hence the existence of me, a mixed race person, despite the fact that colonially always people were separate, except they weren't. at night time, apparently not. So I come from a community that kind of makes a mockery of all the rules, which say, well, we're all very pure and separate. No, actually, we're not. We're not. Here I am. Here's my community. We're living proof that these rules ultimately don't work. But in fact, the rules are put in place because those notions of separateness don't work with humans. They just don't. Hence, probably in Paris, later in World War II, you'd find a French woman with a German guy who doesn't feel like it's just because he's powerful, they've fallen in love, or it's just all these cross... The teacher who throws away her job to go and explore this new place. This is we are seekers. As a species, we seek. That's why we read. We love to engage new ideas. We love to get new stories. We have got massive brains, and they're so often so engaged. So when you get a regime that comes in and says, as happens in A Beautiful Place to Die, says, here's a whole new set of rules, and if you break any of them, you're going to jail. And it's a real police state. I mean, it's a police. People get scared. Where they used to think they could skate through, now that... And the money. I was just astonished by the amount of money that went into this policing of everything. I mean, now the police can do it, but they have these remote cameras. Before, you had to have people on the ground, you know, looking, searching through houses. So when I made my detective, I realized a couple of things. Despite the notion of feeling like I wanted inclusivity in my characters, the truth is that the society just didn't hold that up. And one thing I find frustrating as a historian is if I'm looking at a movie and it's set in 1950 and there's a black FBI agent, I just go, don't do that. Because you rob the black people who actually did get into the FBI in the 60s of all their hard work. You're just kind of like, oh no, it was all cool. They were there, they were represented, you know? And you're like, no, they weren't. Same for women. Don't do that, because you really take away the necessary fight that had to happen for everyone that's had to fight for what they have. And we all have in all different circumstances. We can all understand that. I said it in South Africa because I thought, what an interesting time to be in, from going from a place where it was, here are the broad outlines of how we live, to here are the rules of how we live. And here are the punishments for you breaking the rules. So I had my main character, I made him a white detective because I needed somebody who could open every door in South Africa, and only a white person could do that. You know, I was just reading an article in The Guardian about a magnum photographer who's black, and he decides he wants to go and photograph an old town where his mother was a maid, and he finds it so frustrating because this year in South Africa, people would look at him and go, nope, just close the door on him. He had the cameras and everything. And he said they just assumed he'd stolen the camera from down the road and now he was trying to get into their house. So it was very complicated. So I've got a big racial mix of characters, but I had to have the main guy. Somebody could knock on the door and you had to let them in. And when a cop knocked on your door in South Africa in the 50s or the 60s, you let them in. You let them in. You know, that's a kind of a notion, but it also bred a kind of society where people would then be very subversive.
Can I just jump in there? I'm older than you are, believe it or not. I was brought up in Zimbabwe, and while the same unspoken rules applied, it wasn't a law. But we heard about what happened in South Africa, and we heard about what happened if you were a lighter colour and you could pass for white, as they called it. You would do that because the world would open up for you, as opposed, as you say, to having the door shut in your face. And I was under the impression that your Emmanuel Cooper was actually a little bit mixed race.
I played around with that idea.
But was given an honorary white status. I mean, this is how it was. And there are stories of how families were fractured because somebody, one of them, could pass for white and deemed. And then...
In a crime context, I actually find that kind of fascinating.
Absolutely.
Because I was looking at it from a crime context. So a history and mystery... History, to me, is a mystery. Almost all of it. You encounter it. And when I was started to do research, I thought, oh, how am I going to actually be real? And then I met this professor of history who said, listen, this is how it works for writing. And I told my researcher this. I said, you're allowed to take anything out of my book if you can prove to me with factual evidence that this never happened once in the history of South Africa. Because you can know, but you can't know. So things absolutely, I think to me it's open. It's open slather in terms of where you draw some lines and stuff like that. So, I mean, even your character wouldn't have been a normal Melbournean girl, would she? She would have been very... So,
and that was really interesting because she'd effectively crossed the dark side as far as people thought, hanging out with the bohemians, you know. And they of course, the police immediately went, we're going to blame it on the artists. That was their first go-to because they're those people who live that lifestyle, but they couldn't. But then that sort of almost became part of an element of victim blaming for her. Well, look at the way she was behaving and who she was hanging out with.
She was virtually asking for
it, wasn't she? Because she's hanging out with this crazy crowd. But even within that crowd, it was also really interesting because she was there for the intellectual side of things, and she was there to advance her career. And other women in the group resented that because she didn't hang out in the kitchen and do the cooking and cleaning. So in there, some of those letters and diaries from the women of that period, it gets really bitchy because they just did not like her attitude at all. Mm.
And you capture that well in the novel, the sort of antagonism between Molly and Mary and the others. Would you like to jump in?
I was thinking about what you were saying, both in terms of your protagonist and in terms of everything open. I find it really interesting. You had to choose a white detective because he had to be able to go everywhere. Yeah. And so I chose a very rich young woman for the same reason. Yeah. I thought, well, it would be more interesting if she wasn't rich, but she wouldn't have as much agency. I needed her to be able to have the resources and also the confidence that having a lifetime of resources behind you would give you. Be able to say, I'm going to go here and here and here and I'll first find the money or I'll charm someone into giving me the money, and never to have to worry about about not having resources. It's just that, just like a purely technical idea that this character has to have agency.
Yeah.
So you have to put them in a particular framework.
That's right. And historically, that's right. You know, because your character would have maybe just been, well... not an average Melbourne girl now, but certainly able to go out and hang with artists and, like, you know, go everywhere and have the freedom to do that. But historically, it was actually very difficult for women to get out and do those sort of things. And you often find, like, if you read the non-fiction stuff, It is money. Women have got a tremendous... Yep. That's their agencies. They have money so they can travel and do yep. stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Certainly all the people that I researched, like Nancy Cunard, immensely wealthy.
Yeah.
And that was what enabled them to
yeah.
not have to be reliant on what other people yeah. told them. Yeah. But I was also thinking about what you're saying about it being open. I found in my research about war, roughly, if I could imagine that it happened, it probably did. And sometimes I've been writing this and think, oh, that's a bit far-fetched. And then as I've kept researching and writing, I've just found yeah. an example and gone,
yeah.
oh, there it is. I imagined it, and then somebody actually did it yeah, 100 yeah, years yeah. ago. Maybe yeah. just once, but it was done. Yeah, yeah.
Those serendipitous yeah. moments. And that's quite a good segue into, again, if you test, you capture... I mean, I'm not that old. I don't know Paris in the 1920s. But to me, what you were saying rang very true.
Thanks.
And I'd be interested... I'm a great believer in walking the walk. When you're setting a novel somewhere, to actually walk that. But I know there's Google and all the rest of it that goes on now. So I'd be interested to know how you went about recreating Paris, and then perhaps we can throw that open to Melbourne sure. and to South Africa. Well, just, you know, capturing the sights and the sounds and the smells and all the rest of it that you do, particularly in Paris.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, I'm very lucky that I set her in these, like, Anglophone expat writers, when you've got people like Hemingway and Stella Bowen and Gertrude Stein writing about what it's like in Paris, it's really just very easy yeah. to jump on top of that and create, if I'm creating that world, to use their... flavours and just mix them up mm. and then other people, because they're so famous, other people have spoken about mm. Fitzgerald in Paris and Edith Wharton in Paris, and then you can go to the historians. I had been to Paris a few times, but I didn't go to Paris during the writing of this book. I used mainly research, partly because Paris has changed a lot in the last 100 years. And so I was referencing places that no longer existed, and then parts of, say, I wanted, there's a bit where she goes into poor parts of Paris, and these no longer exist because Paris has moved and changed so much, and mm-hmm. who constitutes, who is a poor person in Paris in 1921 is very different to 2016. And so I thought about going and walking it. I mean, I had a newborn, so it wasn't... It wasn't super practical, and so I did rely on Google, especially Google Street View. So when I went, I'm like, I wanted, okay, that's her building, or yeah. But also, I want it to be a little bit of I want it to be fictional rather than perfectly historically accurate as well. So that I wrote a novel as part of my doctorate, and most of that I can say, here are the footnotes almost in the novel. But this one I wanted to be a bit more like, between these two buildings, imagine another building, and this is where she lives. Yeah. Sort of, it could have happened, it didn't, but it could have, and so just to use that little bit of slipperiness in people's lives to create that space.
And of course, imagination is a wonderful thing, and you do need imagination to fill in the gaps with historical fiction, because the people back then didn't write down everything that you need to know, which is unfortunate and not very bright of them. So you do need imagination. Yeah. So how about recreating Melbourne in the 1930s?
I had a couple of levels of research because I had Molly's story, which was that the sort of the very factual aspects of what happened to her. But in terms of researching Melbourne in that time, I suppose starting with the newspapers, so what's digitised on Trove is great, but getting onto the local newspapers is better. If you can get into the local library or the state library and find the smaller things that aren't digitised, there's often a lot more detail just about daily life and the character in the streets that you can get from those. Gossip magazines like Table Talk in Melbourne, fantastic, because they have all the little silly bits about what everybody's doing, but they also talk about the latest thing in interior design and fashion. Occasionally there's a recipe, so you kind of get an idea of what people are eating, and the ads in the paper too are really great, so you know the things that have no cocaine, because you know, why would you want that? So those are really interesting, and then old maps. So for me, like, the train and tram lines in Melbourne have all changed in that area, so that was really important to work out which train she would have caught, which tram she would have missed on the fatal night, and certainly walking the street, because part of Molly's story was that she missed the last tram and had to walk home. So walking that last part of her route through a suburb, which is Elwood, which to a large degree, there's still a lot of the houses and there's still a lot of the cobbled laneways that are
did
very
Did it give
much
you the creeps
same.
When you were doing that?
It's a bit creepy. I did in broad daylight, though, so not after midnight as she did it. But the really interesting thing for me about that was that there were a lot of people who'd grown up in that area still living there, and when I got to talking to people, they would say, oh, we were always told when we were kids, that's where that girl was killed. And I always thought she was a prostitute. Really? She wasn't. So it was really interesting knowing that the story had in some way remained in the suburb. And we're getting on time, but historical societies too, because photographs of the suburbs, so that you can find out that it was the Regal Fish and Chip Shop was next to Moran and Cato, the grocers, and see what the interior of the grocery shop was like, because they've got a photo of the ladies in white coats standing behind the counter. So always historical societies. Yeah.
Thank you. So,
look, just really quickly, I had two kids under two. I decided, I got the bright idea, I'm going to be a writer now. And then I thought, well, I can't get to South Africa with two kids under two. So I just made up a fictional town. I drew it on a piece of paper because I didn't have the resources to go for real. So I drew it on a piece of paper and I thought about what the town was and who lived there. And then I thought, and no one can slip me up on bus routes or... Because they're always... There's always
someone. Someone will do it.
There's always someone.
Who's doing it still.
Yep, so I did it all and I made it up. But the cop stuff, I had an actual ex-policeman who read my manuscript and told
Fantastic.
Me. And I did make one massive mistake. And if anyone ever finds Thinner's book, I owe them 10 drinks. My father found it. And this is after it was published. And
what?
I was like, oh, no. And he said, don't worry about it. All the people that know it's not true, they're already dead. Because he's 92, so he was like, forget it, you're fine. And I haven't been caught out on this one massive mistake. But there you go, that's what happens when you just make stuff up.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website, www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.